concept of a list of all the available inputs. You could take the value of capital labor ratio in dollars. Simply compare capital labor ratio in dollars in different countries at the Rooney exchange rate. Or take it in some crude physical terms, horsepower per man employed, whatever you like. Now, you can compare the different countries, you see. Now, where would you find the highest ratio of capital per man by any of these measures? Where is it highest? Well, it certainly used to be highest in the United States. I don't know if you've gone down relatively to Japan so much, it's no longer true. But the high capital labor ratio is in the United States. And does this mean that you have a lower rate of profit per capita than any other country? It's a totally absurd way of approaching it. So, all right, let us let them have their capital. Measure capital, it doesn't matter. Samuelson, matter of fact, in his surrogate production function, although he wasn't quite aware of what he was doing until getting younger, he measured stocks of capital in terms of labor embodied. And he made out a list of different economies, one with more capital in terms of labor embodied than the other, and arranged them in order and said that the rate of interest would be lowest where the capital per man in terms of labor embodied would be highest. Well, all right, he puts that forward as a hypothesis. I don't know what it's supposed to correspond to, but he puts it forward as a hypothesis. And then he goes on to say that a process of accumulation will lower the rate of profit. You just write down imaginary lists, different stocks of capital. To suit your own argument, you arrange them in order, such as that which has the highest capital per man has the lowest rate of profit. And then you say, accumulation will lower the rate of profit. Now, if you're going to bring accumulation into it, it's no good starting with your timeless equilibrium. You've got to tell us what kind of economy this is. How does accumulation take place? Is it done by business firms? Or is it property-owning democracy in which households do the saving and somehow convey their savings? That's only been explained how to be used for investment. What are the motives which guide investment? Under what influence does it take place? How does it react on the technique of production? See, this idea of having a given state of technical knowledge embodied in, expressed in a production function is totally out of relation with whatever happens. See, you work out these figures of output, share of wages, ratio of capital output and capital labor. You know, those figures that they do. Then they put a Cobb-Douglas production function. You will always fit Cobb-Douglas production function if the relative shares in your figures happen to be fairly constant. That doesn't prove anything. But supposing the relative shares are fairly constant and the capital output ratio in value terms is fairly constant, doesn't change very much. You have to iron out the booms and slumps and take a long run thing, and then you find the capital output ratio doesn't change very much. And the share of wages in value added doesn't change very much. And output is rising. So you've got rising real wages and a constant rate of profit. The share is constant, and capital output ratio is constant, then the rate of profit on capital is constant. So ex post average realized profits in this period of time, fairly constant. Now what's the good of trying to fit a Cobb-Douglas? Because here you have a position where each point of observation, each date, is drawn from a different technology. You haven't got a production function, you go creeping down it with the rate of profit falling as the real wage rises. Far from it. The real wage is rising, the rate of profit is constant. So say, there's technical change going on such that each point of observation is drawn from a different technology. And so what you've got to consider is how accumulation actually goes on, who gains and who benefits from, who gains and who loses from accumulation, and how accumulation influences and is influenced by technical change. And your production function and your equilibrium have absolutely nothing to tell you at all in any respect to help you to analyze a capitalist economy. But this whole teaching is a total loss. And the reason, the two major reasons are, as I say, that it doesn't take account of the nature of time, and it doesn't take account of the structure of society, and it's always living in a dream world. But following from this is a purely methodological mistake. These people like Samuelson put on a lot of dog about how they're mathematicians, and they make the most elementary blunder in methodology to compare two equilibrium positions and then say you move from one to the other by a process of accumulation. This is an error which a first-year man shouldn't be allowed to get away with. So here is the sad state of teaching of today.
I just scribbled down some notes and in listening to Mr. Johnson, and let me say that there are a large number of points that I did not understand, and therefore I cannot respond to a large number of points. But let me just mention a couple of points. The first point is the question of ideology in economics that you mentioned earlier.
I didn't want to discuss ideology, I
want to
discuss logic.
Well, as I understand you, I interpret you and in some other in saying that it is very difficult, if not impossible, to reason in a logical fraction, since we come to any problem with preconceived notions.
Excuse me, I'm not fighting on that ground. I'm finding on the ground there's a logical inconsistency in the neoclassical scheme. And I don't want to go off onto an argument about ideology.
Do you not want me to say, to respond to the statements like, Marshall was not about twisting the argument to fit his frequency?
Yes, I put that forward as a logical point. It's a well-known logical problem of Marshall's dilemma.
Are you about twisting the argument to your preconceived point?
Well, I suppose they're all human.
Exactly.
Excuse me, if I found, or if you can point out to me any logical error I've made, and you convince me of it, I'll be very glad to hear it.
No, what I'm trying to suggest is that statements like Marshall was not about twisting the argument.
Yeah, this thing of Marshall's dilemma is a very well-known problem. Why do you deny it?
I'm not denying it as a dilemma. I'm just suggesting that if your statement is of the nature of an ad hominem remark, and that I, Marshall, you, all of us, approach any problem with preconceived notions, and this is by no means an attack on Marshall per se, it is an attack on all of us as human beings. As such, we...
Well, but how do you answer the logical problem? If you have perfect competition and increase in the terms of the individual firm,
you're
inconsistent. It's
a
logical problem.
A lot... I intend to make the point I wish to make.
Well, I'll
leave you on that.
I'll
give you a hand. Thank you. What I was going to say, more beyond this point, was that a lot of the criticisms that I detected were criticisms of Valrazian economics as distinct from Marshallian economics. Problems of setting up a system of equations, setting up a description of an economy that consists of many sectors, and that economy working itself out in a self in a consistent system and yielding a consistent outcome. In other words, the problems were problems of reconciling, e.g., microeconomics and macroeconomics. And the criticisms, as I understood them, were not criticisms of naive Marshallian partial equilibrium economics. The nature of the criticism most of the criticisms were about that. The most stringent criticism, as I understand it, of Marshallian economics was the notion that, the statement that, the concept of equilibrium was clearly nonsense. Now, I don't understand that statement, since, as many of your statements, Mr. Robinson, I don't understand what, when you come up with statements like, this notion is clearly absurd, this notion is completely useless, this is totally out of relation with what happens. I understand that as being not a statement about logic, but a statement about the correspondence with our model, with the world. Now, if you are of the nature of what we sometimes call casual empiricism, if you will say that I casually observe the world and my casual observation is that this particular system is inconsistent with it, then of course you are quite right to make statements like this notion is completely absurd. That is not a logical statement, that is a statement about the extent to which a model is consistent with one's interpretation of the world. It's an empirical statement about how the world operates. Now, as far as that is concerned, I believe that the sort of empirical statements you are making about the world are extremely cavalier. And I'm not by any means sure that the sort of empirical, not logical statements, the empirical statements you are making are indeed correct. What I was going to suggest about the concept of equilibrium is that it is a way, not of photographing the world, but of picturing the world as it operates in a particular way. In other words, in the limit, one doesn't have to interpret it like this, but in the limit, one may regard or interpret equilibrium as a tautology, as something that must obtain. Not that it sounds comfortable, not that it sounds good necessarily, but it is convenient to paraphrase all problems as if they were as if an equilibrium model can apply, because we seem to know more characteristics about equilibrium solutions than we do about disequilibrium solutions. That does not mean that picturing the world as if it were an equilibrium makes that world good, right, proper, nice. All it means is we may learn more about the world if we draw pictures that suggests that the world is in equilibrium rather than it not being in equilibrium. That means that the concept of equilibrium, in that sense, since it is a tautology, it cannot be shown to be wrong. But it can be shown to be useless. But the question then comes, the extent to which that concept of equilibrium yields a picture of the world that is useless or not. And here we return to the statement I made before, and that is we are involved in the correspondence of our model with the world. We are concerned then with empirical statements about the world and not logical statements about the world. And as far as that's concerned, as I say, I find comments about how the world operates of the form, this is clearly absurd, clearly the world doesn't work like that, clearly this, it's not clear to me, I'm afraid, it is not clear. It's not clear to me that a lot of these models are solutions. But let me say that let me say that there is a lot about the sort of economics Mrs. Robinson was criticizing that I do not fully understand, that are clearly puzzles. That is the nature of any science. If there were no puzzles, we could go home to bed and start worrying about sociology, perhaps, or become physicists. If there were no problems in the world, if there were no problems with our models, I'm afraid there would be no Department of Economics. There would be no, this is true of all science, that there are unresolved problems. To show that there are puzzles, to show that there are unresolved problems, is not tantamount, it's not equivalent to saying, therefore everything is done. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
I would like to speak just very briefly in sympathy with many of the things which I heard Mrs. Robinson say at the beginning of her lecture, and in extension of what Jonathan Cavill has just said. I heard very clearly the answer that neoclassical economics was an inadequate analytical approach. I did not hear the question to which that was the answer. I did not hear a statement about the character of the problem to which this analytical apparatus was to be addressed. And this is essentially the same point that Jonathan Cavill has made, that the attack on neoclassical theory as inadequate and useless is one. That's where I have a difficulty, because I did not hear an attack on the logic of the Walrasian system or on the logic, the internal logical consistency of algebraic equilibrium. What I heard was something which is well known to people who are interested in the peculiar kinds of problems which occupy me as an economic historian. What I heard was a reiteration of the point which has long been known, but which should be perhaps better known in people who are currently being taught economics, that neoclassical economics is a fundamentally ahistorical system. It was conceived, patterned on classical mechanics. If one reads, and I don't need to tell you certainly, and reads Valras or Jevons, one sees that it was their objective to create a physico-mathematical system which would do exactly what classical mechanics did. It would show how a system would converge to an equilibrium, a steady state, which would perpetuate itself. Now, a long time before Jevons or Valras, Friedrich List, Roscher, Nyes, Schwaller, the members of the younger German historical school, had criticized the free trade animus of classical economics precisely because it was ahistorical and was irrelevant to the policy problems of economic growth in the nation state which they were trying to make. The ahistorical character of classical and neoclassical theory has been apparent for some long time. The question is whether the methodology of classical mechanics, whether the methodology of building equilibrium systems is instructive to understand the world. It is the problem of empirical correspondence. Now, I think it's quite clear, that I just have one more word on this, that those of us who are interested in historical processes, obviously are conscious that the system of general equilibrium, as it has been worked out to produce the ergodic solutions in which the past has no influence over the steady state to which the system converges, is not going to be illuminating of the nature of historical questions. But it seems that the question which I would like to hear you respond to is, do you think there is any range of problems with which economists should be concerned, which can be treated by methods other than the methods of history? I say this with mixed feelings, because I would like you to say no. Everyone must become an economic historian. But I wonder whether you would say that.
Yes, I have any problem with myself.
Oh, is it you? Was your answer that I come out on your side or you're on mine?
What I think is that it's necessary to have a kind of economic theory which would be useful to historians. Up till now, in the modern times, the economic theory has been cut off from applications to reality by this concept of equilibrium. It would be useful to get a kind of economic analysis which would go back to the classics and to Marx and develop and that kind of analysis would be useful in this world. That's been my aim for the last 40 years.
Well, I applaud that endeavor, but I would submit that that does not constitute attack on the internal logical inconsistency of the neoclassical system. It simply says that it's not relevant to a second problem.
My attack on the logical consistency of the concept of equilibrium was precisely that the mechanical analogy does not apply to anything concerning human life. That's my point. Because of this question of uncertainty, decisions having to be taken in the light of uncertainty. This knocks out the mechanical analogy on which equilibrium has been based. So William Jaffe found out that Barras got his idea in the first place from an engineer. The engineer had amused himself by working out the price ratios by an analogy with weight. Barras took this up and thought this was going to answer his problem, and it didn't. That's just my point.
The problem to which De Broglie and Arrow return, and that is, how is it possible that a decentralized system in which individual decision makers communicate only through the market and respond only to price signals, how might it be possible for such a system to produce a coherent result?
Well,
if that is the problem,
especially Arab and Rose, it's a device for getting away from time. So you have all the future prices are revealed today, and then everybody makes their decisions. Now there's a difficulty about it, because the signals are given to the producers in terms of prices. And you have constant returns and people firms, you see. So it's difficult to know how they know the correct amounts of the commodities to produce. See, by working it all out, you can find out what the amounts of the commodities ought to be. But the signal prices with constant returns won't tell the firms, won't tell the economy how much it ought to produce. So I met De Broglie the other day, and I asked him. I said, "How do you solve this problem? What is the signal to the firms?" He said, "I'm not interested in the question of whether the equilibrium could be attained. I'm only interested in the question of showing that there is an equilibrium." Well, this seems to me that it's not going to take us very long. The whole problem of time. This Arrow De Broglie game is another way, like party capital, of getting away from the problem of time.
So, I want to clarify one thing, because it seems to me that the capital is a bit of a red herring, because it borders on a kind of a criticism, and that has not to be Joan Arden's point. She's not saying that one needs to look more closely at the facts and try to find out what they are. She's rather asking the question of what sort of theory you have to guide you in examining the facts and in explaining the evolution of capitalist economies. Now, that's quite a different problem, since we from the kind of formulation that John introduced, clearly in dealing with the facts, one has all sorts of complications to take account of anyway. So if anyone would grant that, then the facts exist, no doubt, in some statistical sense, but always the question arises in dealing with such statistics, what is the theory that explains them? And it seems to me, if I interpret her correctly, that she's rather saying that so far as the Pauvrasian equilibrium system is concerned, and systems of general equilibrium, there is no indication at the level of theory as to how processes of adjustment occur, how one moves from one equilibrium position to another, for instance. What is usually done, and this is the way in which Samuelson budgets the problem, is to appeal to a kind of correspondence principle, which itself begs the question of what the underlying process is by which movement takes place from one equilibrium to another. That's rather what the issue is, not whether in fact the theory as such is immediately applicable to any particular concrete practical problem. That, of course, one of the points is that it is not, but that's quite beside the point. The other point is whether at the level of theory there is any indication, any theoretical statement underlying the adjustment process, indicating what the adjustment process is, that would take place in a dynamically developing capitalist economy. And you really haven't taken up that point at all. It seems to me that you move very rapidly from the level of theoretical argument to a rather empiricist notion about the use of theory in explaining practical events.
I'm not really following what your objection is, Don.
Let me put it this way. I mean, the point about the self-contradictory nature of the equilibrium system is revealed immediately considering how does the process of adjustment take place from one equilibrium to another. How do you get into equilibrium from any initial starting point?
What does it mean, getting into equilibrium? The mechanical analogy breaks down as soon as you bring in the fact that human beings take a view about what's going to happen next.
Well, but that's precisely the point, that the models have been set up not to explain how a real world system gets into equilibrium. The models have been set up for the purpose of showing that this is the kind of structure which will converge to a steady state from any initial position, and that the kinds of models that people work on because they're more mathematically practical, have an autonomous equilibrium imposed on.
Well, I think it's just a distraction for the moment to eat them, because it has an advantage. You make a model in which you have perfect information.
Well, I think.
Could you speak up?
From the discussion of Mrs. Robinson, Professor Penkav, Professor David, it seems to me there is a little bit confusion on the level of the discussion. It seems to me that there are three fundamental points. One, what are the questions, Professor David, that we are addressing? What do we want to explain? The second one is, for any given model, the checking of its logical consistency. The third one, which is the most important one, is the problem of real science. What's real science? What I understand from the discussion of Mrs. Robinson, that you want basically to explain how economics going and evolving through time periods, how a given economy is changing and developing. The next question was that she was continuing with attacking basically the Aero-Debray general equilibrium system. The Aero-Debray general equilibrium system, given its assumption, is completely logically consistent. Given the assumption of convexity, the existence of all contingent market, you give some existent rule, and you can prove also that it's Pareto efficient. The question, is it relevant? So it's not relevant because it doesn't explain really how economy moves through time when there are changes, all the problem of adjustment and stability. I think the majority of the people around here attack also the problem of real science. By observing the real world, it seems that the basic assumptions also in the outlook, as if out, and also the prediction seems to be far from this given model. It seems like Mrs. Robinson, I think, specified a couple of points what's wrong in this explanation. The first point, as I see, was the problem of ambiguity, uncertainty, future risk. The second point was approaching the nature of the economy through kind of, not through equilibrium concept, right, but through this equilibrium concept, and by that, looking at economic in different states, kind of timely. Then she was continuing to mention the problem of increasing return to scale, the existence in this world, if you want to explain this world, of big corporation, and she was concluding with the contradiction between the relation between the capital labor ratio and the rate of profit. I think many of us are aware that given this world, observing this world, this problem exists. And as I see, for example, the error the blessed school, the way it's going these days, is trying to address this point. The approach is taking the basic model, which is basic assumptions, and which don't explain basically what's going on, and to try to modify it, to try to bring some concept of uncertainty, to try to bring some concept of non-convexity, etc. Is this approach will be useful or not? This is a question. Till now, it doesn't seem to help so much, but that's a question. The question I want to address Mrs. Robinson, more concrete term, I think many of us are feeling that the lack of ability of a given theory to explain what's going on and to give us a picture about the world, whatever it is. To be more concrete, for example, Mrs. Robinson, to the point of risk, she said, for example, there was an attempt in neoclassical theory to approach risk through expected utility, all kinds of stochastic processes. She basically tried to say that we have to ignore the problem of probability and to try to approach expectation in different ways. Perhaps it was also in the back of her mind the attack on the maximization of utility and get rid of the rationality and to try to get a different approach. What I would like to hear from you, Mrs. Robinson, more specific way, we agree basically that many things are wrong in neoclassical theory. But if you would like to pursue me, right, what specifically, I understand that you have to bring this concept. I think the majority of the problem lies that we are, seems unable really to do it. It's not only the lack of will in some way. And I would like perhaps if you have more specific suggestion out of what the problem.
Well, this business about error and error, I think is a very telling because error and error is not even trying to tell us anything about the problems we're interested in, such as the process of accumulation, the distribution of income. They have a world in which nothing is of any interest or importance except the prices of commodities. That seems to me to be a very narrow line. But even if, I don't believe it's right, I think there's a catch in it, but even if it's right, it's not interesting. But I was accusing Samuelson of making a definite mistake, and such a mistake that you shouldn't allow a first year student to make it. And that is depicting different positions of equilibrium, and then without any further explanation, assuming that you can move from one to the other by a process of accumulation. I mean, this confusion between comparisons and processes, this is a definite mistake. The other mistake is thinking that you can derive from the productivity to society as a whole of an increment in the means of production to the rate of profit on capital. It's simply a mistake. Now, these are two complete mistakes in methodology, mistakes in logic. I mean, you run off into this error of error thing, it's very dizzy-making because it's so very hard to find out what they are really saying. But these two points, I think, are fairly definite and quite important. Now, as for the question of how we should reconstruct economic teaching, I mean, we must go back. I mean, as I say, many people came to the bad word, so let's say go back to Kolesky and develop the short period analysis. And then, when you're looking at it in that way, applying a short period analysis both to problems of prices and problems of accumulation, And then you'll find that your ideas are linked with the ideas of the classics. Because the classical economists were interested in the problem of what really is happening in an economy. They weren't going off into all sorts of fancy ideas which have no application. They were really trying to understand how the economy works and putting up hypotheses about it. So you find a link with Ricardo's theory of profits, with Stoffer's explanation of Ricardo, with Marx, joining up the classical approach with the Keynes or Kaminsky approach, and let the neoclassical intervening period just sink into the floor. I mean, there's some useful ideas. In this book, I've tried to incorporate any ideas which are useful from the neoclassical speed, like, for instance, elasticity of demand and the inelastic demand for agricultural products. That the more you sell, the less you get. And this explains the problem of the farmer who hangs himself in the expectation of plenty. So this is a very important and useful idea, which you don't find in Marx, which you do find in Marshall. There are a number of tricks like that which one can use and find the problems in which they apply.
We haven't seen number of Western, which seems to be the problem which is implicit in much of the region anyway. What sort of economic system is specified within the framework of general equilibrium theory? Structural conditions in a capitalist economy is incorporated? I mean, the specification from the start is of an economy in which all individuals have a vector of endowments appropriate to the existing composition of inputs in production. So from the start, there's no conception of a division of the society, so to speak, between those who own and those who do not own. Those who own merely labor and those who own some means of production. To say nothing of the additional questions that she raised. I mean, it seems to me that this is quite basic to the art, to the reasoning, and it's not at all taken into consideration in the kind of point that was made by David and Ben Campbell. I wonder if they'd like to respond to that.
I thought you were saying
that
it's been interesting, having a story
Well, I think that let me try and respond to two points. One, I think the question that you've raised on is a difficult methodological question, having to do with the problem of verification or falsification of models, and in what respects it is legitimate or illegitimate to take the so-called positivist position that falsification is based on a correspondence between the inferences tautologically extracted from the model and what happens, say, what one can observe in the real world. The preceding discussion has been based to some extent on to address that kind of problem. When one says that neoclassical system is irrelevant, the question is whether it is because it's not predicting well, or the thought that you touched on, with which I'm sympathetic, is one dismissing it as irrelevant because the axiom set from which the theory is developed makes it difficult to talk about phenomena in the real world within the terms of the model. And one can then say it doesn't matter whether it predicts or doesn't predict. What does it mean to predict only some things? That the predictions of the theory are not different from the axioms or the premises. And that's a position which Samuelson took in in arguing against Freeman, against F-twisting, okay? That's a position which I think you you want to associate yourself, and I would associate myself with. And so it's a legitimate empirical objection to any theory, neoclassical theory or not, that one says that the premises which we are asked to swallow make it difficult for us to explain some, if you like, prior, what are sort of prior, extraneous observations about the world. Now, there are in all things trade-offs. That is, the real questions are theories which have to explain everything we know about the world at once are very hard to develop. And in most of our life, in most fields, one tends to proceed by a process of reduction and limitation and putting aside certain phenomena to try to isolate the subset of phenomena which one is going to comprehend within explanation. What is in that subset and what's out of that subset is sort of a strategic decision which results in the difference between the successful and unsuccessful scientific lines of inquiry. I don't think that
one knows. When I repeat that comment, I'm not talking about the realism of the assumption. I'm talking about a methodological error, which is to describe a process which is supposed to be going on through time in terms of a comparison of time as equilibrium positions. It's a methodological error. From that stems a great number of mistakes in interpretation and so on. But it's a methodological error in the very basis of the theory.
Can I respond directly to that? You see, your removal of Paul Samson's PhD on the ground of incompetence seems to be based on a proposal that this be done on the basis of the assertion that the system will sort of traverse between two steady state points. If, let's say, disturbed by change in the rate of population, change in the saving rate, what have you. And you say, well, what if, when the first steady state is disturbed by an alteration in the saving rate, what will happen? And now, in the terms in which the system has been set up, the loanable funds market is made to clear. That's an assumption. Ex-ante savings and investment are equal. So there is no short period worth talking about in the terms to which the system has been set up. And you can prove that it will traverse in the right direction because you built that into the structure of the model. Well, so that when you say it's an elementary methodological fallacy, what you're saying, and I agree with you, is that it abstracts from the problem of what happens in the short period if the savings rate changes and knocks you out of full employment. Then you have to worry about the short period before you can just simply assume that.
They won't even deploy that problem or state any of their propositions without using this conception of cutting capital. It would be under. You invest in a machine, and this is a certain quantity of cutting, and then you can take that same cutting and squeeze it out and make it into a different machine. And they cannot deploy their pre-Keynesian model without making that assumption. That assumption is necessary to be able to deploy that argument in which you have saving determines investment and your continuously needing.
But in what says
the
law is speaking on that cover as
well. The results on traversing are proof for vintage models.
But you say it's not holding all the time.
Yes.
And that is the point.
Well, okay, on the vintage model, Sam set out a thing for the vintage model. He has the household savings. He first has a propensity to save out of net income. Then he introduces the vintage. Now, the vintage model, you need one more equation to determine the length of service life of the plant. If you have the great grossness. That tells you how many machines are going to replace it, you know. So he says, well, now I'll change the assumption and make it gross, say, saving up a gross income. So the unfortunate households are not only doing saving, but they're managing businesses when they're replacing the car. I mean, this whole thing really doesn't stand up, I'm sure.
Thank you. The problems are, I think, much more subtle than you make them appear. The question, and one should always stop asking, what is the question for which the model proposed the answer?
Yeah, well, the question,
the question may not be what
accumulation takes place
in
a capitalist economy. How does accumulation take place in a capitalist economy?
Well, over what?
Watch me out for the world in which everything's made of butter, the household's safe.
The question, that's not a sufficiently precise question to be intelligently discussed. The question is, what takes place in, how does accumulation take place in the capitalist economy over the short run, within a span of time encompassing the business cycle, but nothing, you know, nothing more? Or are we talking about a process played out over 50 years, over 60 years? The studies that people have done within the context of the neoclassical growth model show that the convergence is likely to be a very slow process. And it doesn't make sense at all to think about these as dynamic systems for discussing the short run. The relevant question is, does it make sense to think of them as giving you some insights into what the process looks like if you're talking about the way accumulation takes place in the capitalist economy over half a century or more? Does the movement from one steady state configuration to another give you some...